Now we come to something very important, and that's what my program through these years tried to do, and that's what I try to do in this book, to show there is no high or low culture, that any person can love Bach or a lead by Schubert or a piece by Mozart.
That's Studs Terkel, and this is Writer's Voice, where the conversation goes deeper. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Later on, we'll play an interview with Terkel that we first broadcast on Writer's Voice last September. But first, we talk with poet and children's book author Richard Michelson. 2 weeks ago, we aired his reading from his newest book for children, Across the Alley. This week, we air the rest of our interview. He talks about two others of his books for kids, Happy Feet and Too Young for Yiddish. By the way, Michelson's Happy Feet came out long before the movie about penguins was an inkling in the cinematographer's eye. Many of Michelson's books are set in New York, the city he grew up in. Some are set in Brooklyn, like Across the Alley, but Happy Feet is set in Harlem. Your books are set in New York, by and large, and I'd like to start with Happy Feet, which is not about a dancing penguin, but...
I did get there first, the original Happy Feet.
The original Happy Feet. But it's a story of a young boy and his father in Harlem in the 1920s. And your books really do stress, as well as your poems, really stress family and the connections of family. So I wonder if you could first just give us a context of the book.
Well, Happy Feet is ostensibly about the old Savoy Ballroom in New York, which captured my imagination as it was the first fully integrated ballroom, a place where blacks and whites could come and dance together, where the daily cares of the world were left behind, and you were only judged on how much fun you were having and how well you could dance. And that was certainly interesting to me, growing up as I did in a mixed neighborhood. So it was always in the back of my mind. The story, however, focuses on a father and his son. The father, in this case, wanted to be a great dancer, but ended up giving up his dreams for a better life so that his family can have some security.
And he is a shoeshine.
He ends up opening a shoeshine shop right across the street from this legendary Savoy Ballroom. So while I'm hoping to teach a little history here and put things in context, by and large, it is a family story of a father and son. And the son gets to follow his own dreams in life.
Yeah. So, and what got you interested particularly in this period and the Savoy Ballroom?
Well, I came to it through some artwork in my gallery. We have some wonderful Savoy Ballroom dance watercolors by Richard Yard, who many people know is based in this area and teaches at UMass, an incredible artist. As well, I did an exhibition of original artwork by the painter Billy D. Williams. And it was Billy who, when he was showing the work, brought in some wonderful watercolors he had done and some paintings, some oil paintings of the Savoy Ballroom. Billy and I talked a little bit about the time and the period, and I was very fortunate that E.B. Lewis, who has turned into a very good friend and is considered by many to be one of the foremost illustrators working today, agreed to step in and illustrate the book.
I'd like you to read an excerpt, and maybe you can give a little bit about the setting right here. But I'd like to start. This is a day when the ballroom opens, and the father of the story has opened his shop. Maybe you could describe what we're seeing on the page, and then I'd like you to read right into his "He Flips Me Into the Air."
Well, the young boy in this story, who has been nicknamed Happy Feet, because he happens to have been born on a legendary day in history, which was the first day that the Savoy Ballroom opened. It was an incredible opening. It was in March 1926. And I'll step back a page just to give you that basis. Mama says any day I was born would be special. But Daddy says the 12th of March, 1926 was extra special. It was the day the doors swung open on the Earth's hottest, coolest, most magnificent, super deluxe dancing palace, the Savoy. Well, the boy does grow up to get to know some of the mainstays at the Savoy and the legendary dancers. His hero is Frankie Manning, who I must say is in his mid-90s now, invented, if we can say, the Lindy Hop. And he is still dancing. He's been up to the gallery a couple of times where he's taught dance, and it's amazing to watch him move around the dance floor. Every birthday, he goes once around a room wherever he's dancing at his party, and he takes a different woman for one time around the room. So it started with a tradition at his 75th birthday when he got to Lindy Hop with 75 women, and he's going strong. He's in his 90s.
That's great. Yeah, so he's going to have to hit 90 women this time,
well,
right?
Well, more than that. I think he's 92 or 93 now. And I have to say that when I first chose Frankie Manning as the hero of the boy in my book, I frankly had no idea he was still alive. And what wonder it was to find out that not only is he alive, he's still dancing, and he looks like he's 20, 30 years younger than he is. An amazing man, and he's become a friend, and I'm pleased to have gotten to know him. The book, after a bit, some of the old-time dancers come in, and they're kidding around with Happy Feet and his dad, and they convince his dad to tell a story, one that Happy Feet has heard before. But it's become his favorite story. The dad says, "Your mama was upstairs resting," my daddy says, "with a dancing baby in her belly." I smile because I know daddy's spouting about me. Daddy smiles too. "I was locking up," he tells me, "and listening hard for your mama, when Twistmouth himself knocked on the door asking the cost of a premium shine. No charge," I told him. "It's jelly on the cuff." "Well then, alligator," he said, "are your boots laced?" And he ticketed us both across the street to the head of the line. There were ballrooms before, my daddy says, but none like Savoy. When we walked in, Big B was sparking a dance so new it didn't even have a name yet. Shorty was spinning till he was dizzy, and Stretch was reinventing flight. Then Twistmouth started gyrating through the air. "I started flying," Daddy says, "for the fun of it. It was a dance derby, and I didn't even know it. The cats were clapping, the floor was bouncing, my heart was beating, and everybody was cheering. Everybody." Daddy rolls back his buff bag and grabs my hand. We spin and dip around the chairs, and then he flips me into the air.
We're talking with poet and children's book author Richard Michelson. That's wonderful. Now tell us who Twistmouth was, and why was he called Twistmouth?
Well, there were some great nicknames back then. In the book, we come across Big B, and there was Long-Legged George and Short-Legged George. Twistmouth George was George Ganaway, and he invented the twist step. Which is a swivel which replaced the basic back step in the Lindy. But nicknames were great. Frankie Manning was called Musclehead, and there was Stretch Jones and Whitey White. It was just a wonderful lingo, and I loved learning about it. I loved reading the old newspapers and trying to capture the voice of the times.
So how did you get to meet Frankie Manning? And what was he like?
Well, I got to meet Frankie Manning because my daughter, who lives in New York City, was out at a dance club one night and called me up and said, "Did you ever hear of somebody called Musclehead Manning?"
And had you written the book yet?
I was writing the book.
Oh, at this moment.
And... And she said, "Because I just danced with him last night." And I said, "Well, I don't know how that is possible, because he's from history, And I checked, and in fact, as I mentioned, he was out there dancing and teaching dance. I called some people who called some people who finally got me in touch with him. And I drove down to Brooklyn, where he was living. We agreed to meet at a restaurant, and I got there first. I was I sat in the back, and I went up to talk to the maitre d' to say, I'm expecting to meet a gentleman. He's in his mid-90s, and could you please let me know when he arrives? I was expecting to see an old man with a cane or a hobble or what to walk into the restaurant. And I was totally unprepared for the what I thought was young man that strode in looking a lot better than I did. And he was just wonderful, and we had a very nice time.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet and children's book writer Richard Michelson. So what was his reaction when you told him you were writing a book about him?
Well, I mean, he was pleased. He asked to read it. You know, the book is really more about the times, etc. And Frankie is really just mentioned as the boy's hero. But what was very nice to me was when he did read the book, and he called me up and he said, "You got it. You got the lingo. I could hear the talk. I could hear my friends, and it was just wonderful."
So, and how did you find out about the language? You know, I thought about this jelly on the cuff. I've never heard that before, but you know, I knew what it meant from the context.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the fun thing about writing is you do get to dig into different times, different places, different voices. In this case, the book is written through the voice of a young black boy, and certainly as a Jewish, as a white Jew, it was a bit of a stretch, and I encounter some opposition from some people who felt that this was a story best left to African-American people to write and tell. I have a different viewpoint on that, and I don't know that this is the show necessarily to get into it.
Oh, I'd like to hear what is your viewpoint on that?
Well, I've written, I think one of the things that we should try to do as writers and as people is try to enter each other's skin and see what other people are experiencing. I don't feel, while many of my books are written in the viewpoint of a young Jewish boy, I feel I have more to offer, and I don't think that I need to be kept to just that subject. I do recall calling up Frankie the first time I spoke to him and told him about the book. When we were planning on meeting, I told him right away that, by the way, when you're looking for me, I'm the tall, white Jewish guy. And without missing a beat, Frankie said, "My girlfriend's white and Jewish too." So the best part of that was him having a girlfriend in his mid-90s, I think.
That's great. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're listening to an interview I recorded several weeks ago with Richard Michelson, Northampton Art Gallery owner, poet, and children's book author. Next, I asked him about his book, Too Young for Yiddish. In Too Young for Yiddish, we have a sense of both the losses of an older generation as well as the legacy to the new ones. The legacy of the Holocaust is very lightly touched on in the book. It's really the story of a grandfather and his grandson. I wonder if you could just give us a brief sense of the story, and then I have another question to ask you.
All right. Well, Too Young for Yiddish is also a story about a grandfather and his grandson. As it turns out, the grandfather who grew up in the old country, the little boy is never quite sure where the old country is, but he does hear that his grandfather spoke Yiddish in the old country and even spoke Yiddish to the chickens. The little boy wants to learn Yiddish because he wants to talk to chickens, but the grandfather wants very much for his grandson to be all American, to fit in, to, in a sense, turn his back on his heritage. Like many, I think, in my generation, whose parents or grandparents were immigrants. What they wanted for their children was something better, something more. In this case, Zadie wants Aaron to learn to play baseball. Why learn Yiddish? Why worry yourself with the old country? You're an American now, he says. The little boy grows up learning in school history and learning about other cultures and other people's ways of life, but he forgets how little he knows of his own family and where they come. And I think this is somewhat typical in the schools where we do teach history, but children don't realize, I think I say in the book, history is what happens to real people. Your grandparents, their parents, what you're going through right now, you're living through history. And I remember a time when my son came home from school and he was doing a paper on the 60s. And I said, well, would you like to talk to me about it? I lived through it. And he was too busy. He was too busy doing his paper and doing his research. What could I offer? We often don't turn to family for stories. And in many, in an immigrant generation, the older generation is not anxious to pass down their stories, and the children often are not interested in hearing about it.
I can remember asking my grandfather, who emigrated here in 1912, after the pogroms in Russia. I asked him what was it like back then in Russia, and he wouldn't tell me.
Right, yes, and that's not an infrequent response. In this story, what happens is Zadie moves into a nursing home, and the rooms are kind of small. And he's throwing out his Yiddish books because his friends have passed on and the younger generation can't read it. And he reaches a point where he does realize that what he's throwing out is very much his history. And Aaron, the young child who's grown up now, decides that he does want to know where he's come from so he can have a full life. And he goes to Zadie and asks to learn to read some of those books.
Yes. You know, I have to ask you, too, the young Aaron, as he when he grows up, has a remarkable resemblance to you. Is this deliberate? Is this an autobiographical story to some degree?
Well, all my stories have some degree of autobiographical basis, and then my first obligation is to the story, not to my life. And so very much I have to change what happens. I try to consolidate characters. I follow the story where it goes. But generally, it begins in an interest I have in something in my background that I want to explore. And I see where it leads me. In this particular case, the artist, Neil Waldman, illustrated this book completely and called me up. I had not met him. And he wanted to drive up and meet me and show me what he had done. And Neil came up one day, and we talked, a very nice guy and also a wonderful illustrator. And while we were talking, I found him continually staring at me from one side and then from another side. And finally, he asked, how soon does this book need to come out? Would you mind if it were delayed by a season? In the publishing world, there tend to be spring and fall releases. And I asked why. I thought he had done a very nice work. He said, because I think in order for me to find the real feeling in what I've done here, I would like to use you as the model for Aaron in this book. And the earlier version of the book was much more generalized people. So he did use Aaron. He used my son, actually, as the young Aaron. And his own grandfather actually is the grandfather in this book. What tends to happen once a book comes out and things get settled like this, my children who never met their grandfather see myself in this book and the grandfather, and this now becomes their vision of what my grandfather looked like. Because they never met him, and they see him interacting with what looks like me in this book.
That's wonderful. Well, Richard Michelson, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And you're also giving a reading with poet Martina Spada.
I've got a few readings coming up. Martina Spada, who I must say also grew up in East New York neighborhood. And a little bit after me, in the poem I read, I mentioned it was a black neighborhood, and then the Puerto Ricans drove out the blacks. Well, Martine was the next generation in that same neighborhood. And we will be reading, I believe, on the last day of February at the Odyssey bookstore. And I will be reading from Across the Alley at the National Yiddish Book Center. I might also read Too Young for Yiddish at the time on December 25th, and that is not a error. It is the solstice that the book center will be celebrating with a program there. So I believe I'll be reading in the afternoon around 1. And I will also be speaking at the university again at the Perspectives in Literature Conference. This, I believe it's coming up in March.
Wonderful. Okay, and we'll link to those announcements, and we'll put those announcements on our website at www.writersvoice.net.
Thank you very much.
That's poet and children's book author Richard Michelson. Playing some tracks today from previous shows on Writer's Voice. Here's one from our interview with Maxine Kumin, whose poetry often takes up the theme of our relationship to the non-human living world around us. I interviewed Kumin about her latest book, Jack and Other New Poems. The title poem is about a horse she once had.
Jack. How pleasant the yellow butter melting on white kernels, the meniscus of red wine that coats the inside of our goblets, where we sit with sturdy friends as old as we are after shucking the garden's last silver queen and setting husks and stalks aside for the horses, the last two of our lives still noble to look upon, our first foal now a bossy mare of 28, which calibrates to 84 in people years, and my chestnut gelding, not exactly a youngster at 22. Every year, the end of summer, lazy and golden, invites grief and regret. Suddenly, it's 1980, winter batters us, winds strike like cruelty out of Dickens. Somehow, we have 7 horses for 6 stalls. One of them, a big-nosed roan gelding, calm as a president's portrait, lives in the rectangle that leads to the stalls. We call it the motel lobby. Wise old campaigner, he dunks his hay in the water bucket to soften it, then visits the others who hang their heads over their Dutch doors. Sometimes he sprawls out flat to nap in his commodious quarters. That spring, in the bustle of grooming and riding and shoeing, I remember I let him go to a neighbor I thought was a friend, and the following fall she sold him down the river. I meant to, but never did go looking for him to buy him back, and now my old guilt is flooding this twilit table. My guilt is ghosting the candles that pale us to skeletons, the ones we must all become in an as yet unspecified order. Oh, Jack, tethered in what rough stall alone, did you remember that one good winter?
Now, you said that that's your guilt poem, and
yes.
I wonder, when you read it, and you must read it quite a lot or be asked to read it, does that guilt come up again?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So it's a painful thing to read.
Yeah, I feel very bad about what I failed to do, my sin of omission. I found it very hard to believe that this young woman would do such a thing. You know, I was just incredulous when she told me.
Yeah. And down the river means?
She sold him to who knows? Mm-hmm. She sold him to somebody.
Yeah. Well, you know, that kind of gets to one of the questions that I had for you. Your poetry looks full face on some very difficult and painful things. There are the themes in your poetry. I mean, the beautiful connection. The connection to the natural world is one that brings both great joy and great pain, considering the state of the natural world these days.
Right.
And a lot of your poetry, for example, in Nurture, the poem Nurture, as well as in the poetry volume Nurture, you take up the theme of what is going on with the planet, how animals are being destroyed, how species are being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that pains me whenever I read or listen to a report on the radio or something that talks about the death of a species. I feel it viscerally.
Yes, I agree. So do I.
And often it's too painful for me to really remain there. I switch to another channel. I turn to a different page. But when I read the poems in Nurture, I was able to look full face at this through the medium of your poetry. And I wonder if you could talk about that. In what way can poetry enable us to contemplate the horror in a way that doesn't destroy us?
Well, it's a delicate balance between, you know, writing a polemic and writing a poem. How it operates upon the individual, I think it has to operate artistically. In other words, it has to be a good poem. Then it can convey a message. And I've been particularly taken with this kind of, what shall I call it, not quite conflict, but the difficulty of bringing the two together. In the new book, Still to Mow, there are a whole series of torture poems. And my way of handling it was to write in form. One is a villanelle, one is a pantoum. I mean, to use these archaic old forms to talk about entering houses at night, for example, or what you do to the ghost prisoner. That really was a dilemma. I think it exists on any level. Anything that goes beyond the simply lyrical has to engage with the world as it is. And I guess Nurture is one poem that does. There are a lot of others. I'm thinking of With the Caribou. Many of the poems in the volume Nurture do this, but having just found it, I'll be happy to read this poem if you'd like.
I'd love to have you do that, but I also would like to ask you to tell us what a pantel and a pantoon
and
a villanelle are.
Oh, come on. Well, the villanelle is an old, old French form, and it's written in three-line stanzas, and the first line and the third line of the first stanza have to get repeated in a certain order. And then the final stanza is four lines. So you have two open lines, and then you have to use your first line and your third line to complete it. So, you know, technically it's a challenge, but for me form is always so liberating. When I have something hard to say, I seem invariably to wander into this difficulty. Now, the pantoum is an old Malaysian form, but again, there's the issue of the repeat. The first, I hope I'm saying this right, the first and third lines of the first quatrain appear as the second and fourth lines of the second quatrain, and so on and so on and so on. It can be as long or as short as you want it to be. But why I do this, or why I write sonnets, it's just in my bloodstream. And besides, I'm old, and I grew up on formal poetry, and I love formal poetry. I mean, I love poetry that dares to rhyme and that dares to use meter, but at the same time kind of hides the fact that it's doing this. In other words, I'm not interested in a poem where the rhymes chime and chime and chime. I'm interested in slant rhyme, approximate rhyme, surprisingly apt rhymes, but actually the poem Nurture is written in free verse.
I'd love to have you read that poem then.
Okay. Nurture. From a documentary on marsupials, I learned that a pillowcase makes a fine substitute pouch for an orphaned kangaroo. I am drawn to such dramas of animal rescue. They are warm in the throat. I suffer, the critic proclaims, from an overabundance of maternal genes. Bring me your fallen fledgling, your bummer lamb. Lead the abused, the starvelings, into my barn. Advise the hunted deer to leap into my corn. And had there been a wild child, filthy and fierce as a ferret, he is called in one 19th century account, a wild child to love, it is safe to assume, given my fireside inked with paw prints, there would have been room. Think of the language we two, same and not same, might have constructed from sign, scratch, grimace, grunt, vowel, laughter, our first noun, and our long verb, howl.
Maxine Kuman reading from her most recent collection of poems, Jack and Other New Poems. Maxine Kuman reading from her most recent collection of poems, Jack and Other New Poems. You're listening to Writer's Voice. After the break, our interview with the inimitable Studs Terkel. I spoke to him last year about his book, And They All Sang. It's recently been released in paperback. Stay with us. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. Studs Terkel has long been a hero of mine, ever since I read his book, Working, just as I started working as a welder in a shipyard in Baltimore, Maryland, back in the early 1970s. America's greatest oral historian, Louis Studs Terkel, was born in New York City in 1912, but he moved at the age of 10 to Chicago, where he still lives. Terkel received a law degree in 1934, but he decided to forsake the law for radio. He joined the WPA Writers Project and worked in soap opera, news, and sports announcing, writing radio scripts and ads. Then he found a broadcast home at Chicago's fine arts radio station, WFMT, where he hosted the Studs Terkel program from 1952 to 1997, presenting shows of music and commentary. His 14th book, And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey, collects his interviews with some of America's greatest musical figures. Studs Terkel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
The first book of yours that I read was Working, when it came out in 1974. It was the first time I'd ever read the voices of working people.
Do you know something? This book, called And We All Sang, They All Sang, the subtitle, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey, and we'll talk about that word eclectic in a minute. This book, in a way, is a sequel to Working. Instead of the non-celebrated, I don't like celebrities to begin with, those who are celebrated for being, well, Albert Einstein is a celebrity, that's a different thing. George Bernard Shaw is a, but I mean those who are celebrated for being celebrated. No, I find that a working or a so-called ordinary person, a phrase I don't like because it's patronizing, but the non-celebrated person who makes the wheels go round, interviewed for the first time, is a very exciting experience for that person and for me. I'll give you a quick example before we come to the book, this one, on music. I was interviewing this woman, this is about, might have been 30, when I was just beginning the idea of working. I still call myself a disc jockey. The people call me an oral historian, etc. I'm a disc jockey, a guy with records. And so I'm interviewing this woman, and she's in a housing project. And to this day, I can't recall whether she was white or black. She was light-skinned, very pretty, very skinny, bad teeth because of no dental money, and three little kids, 5, 6, 7 years old, running around. They want to have mommy's voice. She's never been interviewed in her life before. So I say to the kids, you be quiet, and I'm going to play your mommy's voice. And so I play her voice. As she hears her voice for the first time in her life, She puts her hand to her mouth and says, "Oh, my God." I said, "What is it?" She says, "I never knew I felt that way before." Well, that is a bingo for me and for her. It's that kind of stuff that excites me. So in a way, this book is about musical artists, either singers or musicians, in the world of classical or jazz or folk or spirituals, who are telling about their vocation, their work. In that way, it's a sequel to Working.
You know, all these folks are pretty famous, but there's an awful lot of homage in this book also to regular, ordinary folks who just make music.
That's right. In the main, they're artists whom I admired, some known to many, some not. Certain opera singers who may or may not be known, like Tito Gobbi, the great Scarpia of our time. Scarpia was the villain of Tosca, the police chief, before whom all Rome trembled. Remember, he tries to make out with Tosca, but she wants to save her lover, Cavaradossi, who's one of the revolutionaries. This is not too long after the French Revolution. And so he's a marvelous singer. He wants to show not just the mean spiritedness of the guy, but a certain drop of humanity in him. But then his favorite aria is in a little-known Verdi opera. It's called Simone Boccanegra, and Simone as in Simon. It was the doge, that's the mayor of a nation state, Genoa. This is back in the 14th century, 500 years before Garibaldi and Mazzini and the unification of Italy. And so here's a song. The old man is now dying, Boccanegra, and he and his opponent, his enemy, another old man, both are dying. And I say, what the hell have we been doing to the young people? We've killed them. Let there be peace. And so he sings this aria called Proletari, Proletari, Plebi, Plebeians, Patrici, another word, and it's a plea for peace. So there are two aspects to his life, he writes. Others are there, and these are classical part. Andre Segovia, the great guitarist, 80 years old with that classical instrument. No electrification. 5,000 people hear those notes and lean forward as he plays, say, his transcription of a Bach piece on the guitar, and they listen. And one comes over at the end who likes Segovia. He says, "But you played too low. I had to sit forth and hear hard." So you know what he did the next time? He played it even lower. And so the person leaned even more. And he says, that's our attention sometimes. And so I go from there to Bob Dylan, to Dizzy Gillespie working with Charlie Parker on a new form of jazz.
I loved your piece on Mahalia Jackson.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the few pieces in the book that's actually your own writing. And a lot of people credit you with, quote, discovering her, but you make a different point.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. In fact, the father of gospel music, and I'll explain the difference in different gospel music and spirituals, but the father, his name is Professor Thomas A. Dorsey, and he was once a jazz player, accompanist of Ma Rainey, who was the teacher of Bessie Smith, and when his wife died, he was saved, you know, theologically saved. And so he played all these gospel songs, a lot of songs he wrote for Mahalia, Precious Lord, Take My Hand, which was, you know, Martin Luther King's favorite song. And he said he was paying tribute to me. You, Studs Terkel, have let us know about... Well, it's so wrong. I was the first white, and that's the point, white disc jockey to do it. But she was known to African-American people by the millions in this country. But until the white guy does it. So that was why I kept that in as a sad commentary. Of course she was known. I was close to her, that's true. And I did MC a network show of hers. Well, Mahalia has a way of singing, because I first heard that, a song called Move On Up A Little Higher. I never heard a voice like that.
And you say that you heard it everywhere you went.
Well, that's the whole point. You just touched a thing. I am combating the line separating them. It shouldn't. I'm gonna move. Very often you find, like my friend John Donahue, was leader of the ex-priest. No, he still was a priest. Leader of the Coalition for the Homeless. His father was a lifetime Chicago fireman, firefighter. And his father's one regret was he never told his firehouse buddies that he loved opera. Now we come to something very important, and that's what my program for these years tried to do, and that's what I try to do in this book, to show there is no high or low culture, that any person can love Bach or a lead by Schubert or a piece by Mozart, anyone. And this, I tell the story of this young British working man who was very thoughtful about everything, but he thought classical music, Beethoven or Mahler or Bach, is not for him. It's people who see on the society page, opening night of the opera or symphony. It's for the woman with the tiara on her head, or the guy with white gloves and a cane. And then one day, it's raining hard, and he wants to gather, he hops into this hallway, and it's a music hall, a symphony hall. And he hears music. He opens the door of the auditorium, and he hears this music. And suddenly he's entranced by it. And it's Mozart. And I listened, he says, and I listened. And I liked it. It lifted me. Suddenly I realized, hey, he wrote this for me, too. That's the point, you see. And they did, as a matter of fact. Some of the great pieces were based upon folk songs of the time. You got Modern Jazz Quartet, a wonderful jazz group, playing Bach. And they play one of his pieces, Ye Ye Su Joy, A Man Desiring. It's something Bach himself would have loved, because folk music was also the seeds planted of some of the great pieces.
Well, some people say that jazz is the American classical music.
No, it's American music. It should be, well, it could be, it's America's contribution to the world, of course. We know that. When Dizzy Gillespie, instead of sending guys with guns over to, forgive me, free Iraq, oh boy, when someone does that, that doesn't win friends. But Dizzy Gillespie in the Middle East, these are people we consider the enemy. They lifted him by the shoulders. The music is something they loved. So it's America's contribution to the world, but not our classical music. It's just part of the music.
And Leonard Bernstein says in your book that...
Well, now, Bernstein gave me the title.
Really?
He said, and we all sang. In the olden days, he's not against technology and tapings and all the new things, but something is happening to the human voice that is lost in the process. He says, in the olden days, everybody singing was like conversation, was part of a cultivated person's life. Singing. And he says that is a great deal of that is lost. Now, I feel it very keenly because I'm going deaf, deaf as a post. I'm known as the great listener. I'm as deaf as they come. Me and Beethoven. And so the point is, he's saying an experience I have when I call on the phone in the old days, I'd say, asked for a friend of mine. Is Charlie Andrews there? He says, no, he's not. Could you tell him Studs called? And the human voice is, sure. Now, today I call, and I say, Charlie's at work. And I dread calling because I get a mechanical voice that says, if you want so-and-so, dial 1. If you want supplies, dial 2. If you want whatever, we got dial. By the time they get the 6, I don't know who I called or what I called about.
Bernstein, he talks about the dumbing down, the kind of instant gratification culture. That's a piece with what you're saying. There's a loss of the intimate human voice here.
See, that's the sad part. Seeking something phony and deleterious to health, whether it be mental health or physical health. Seeking what? Immediate gratification. What is greater gratification than that working man hearing Mozart for the first time and caught by it? What is greater gratification than hearing a piece by Louis Armstrong, West End Blues, my favorite jazz, with his exploring the trumpet the way he did? The trumpet becomes his voice becomes the trumpet, and his partner in this particular recording, Earl Hines, revolutionizes the piano. What is greater satisfaction than hearing a ballad, a Dust Bowl ballad of the Depression days, sung by Woody Guthrie, who, by the way, influenced Bob Dylan very, very much.
From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood...
Yes, that was, he was like his hero, as that comes out in your... And now that interview was a long time ago with Bob Dylan.
Oh, 1962. Some of these interviews, strange, I'm glad you asked that. Some of the interviews were done 50 years ago. I've done this for a long time. And it doesn't matter when it was done. Does it fit today? The description of Tito Gobbi, the great opera, Scarpia, villain describing him and his two feelings, or a wonderful Helden tenor, a Wagnerian tenor named John Vickers, who was great, who didn't like Wagner, by the way. But he describes, he's in an opera called, a contemporary one called Peter Grimes by the English composer Benjamin Britten. It's about the outsider. The whole village doesn't like Peter Grimes. He's a good man, but he can't express the feelings he has. And so it drives them crazy. So the conformists, let's say, putting down and finally killing someone who is different, the outsider. So that stuff always attracted me.
Peter Grimes, Peter Grimes, Peter Grimes. Peter Grimes, we are here to investigate the cause of death of your apprentice, William Stone, whose body you brought ashore from your boat, the boy Billy, on the 26th Ultimo. Do your ways to give evidence.
And Dizzy Gillespie describing how he and Charlie Parker got together and revolutionized jazz with bop following World War II. And Dizzy speaks of jazz, the greatest American ambassador is, better than any bombing plane, better than any artillery you can name. He was in the Middle East facing those others, and they lifted him on their shoulders. They were so excited by the music that is so American, called jazz, now so universal.
That's a theme that runs through the book also. There's a kind of profound humanist current that runs through most, if not all, of these musicians, a profound sense of connection with the world and with larger issues. Is that something that you think you might have elicited by the kind of interview you had, or is that something that was in those people?
You know, that's a good question. You see, how can you separate music from life? You see, music is the basis. You know, Enrico Caruso, if there's a hero to this book, it's the greatest of all opera singers. He used to opera with Babe Ruth, was to baseball, what Charlie Chaplin was to early movies. That art form, or that sports form, and that guy with Caruso, no voice like his. And I got a couple of old-time prima donnas, now long since dead, who spoke with him, who sang with him. And they speak of his generosity of spirit. But the big thing about him, there was a poet named John Chardy of Providence, Rhode Island, and his family came from Italy. But all immigrants would buy a Caruso record. And he said the thing about Caruso is he let the human being know that was more to the human being that was now being expressed. He would do a song, say, O Paradiso, an aria from a little-known opera called L'Africaine. And as he would sing O Paradiso, he would come to the end. That's as high as you could go. He'd go one step further. And I told John Chardy that he sang something to the human species, that you are better than you're behaving at this moment. But you are more thoughtful than you are at this moment. That in you are all these possibilities that Caruso, as the artist supreme, found. So it's that sort of, when you ask, is it connected with? Well, of course it is. You can't separate it. In the opera, Tosca, the heroine, sings a great aria called Vici d'Arte. That's a famous Vici, you know, life and my art. My life and art are one, and that's what the book's about, too.
Do you think that the time might be past, though, for another Studs Terkel? I mean, do you think if you were born 92 years later than you were born, do you think you would have been able to do the same kinds of interviews that you were able to do? Would you have been able to find the same kind of people, the same that you found?
Well, I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for others. But this is the way. I was a sickly child. I had asthma, you know, which I lost coming to Chicago as a wonderful south wind blowing from the stockyards. I lost the asthma. But I was home a lot and heard this music. And it was better medication than anything the doctor prescribed. And so I can only speak of my own experience. So I still call myself a disc jockey, although...
Well, you really had a kind of the radio dream job.
It was my hour. I could do anything I wanted, read a short story by John Cheever or Flannery O'Connor, you know, and then play music or do a documentary. So what better life could I have than that one for some 50 years?
For sure. Thank you, Studs. I'm gonna move up a little higher. Gonna meet old man Daniel. Gonna move. We have a few minutes before the end of today's program, so let's hear some poems that have been read one time or another on this show. First, Northampton poet Gail Thomas reads from her collection No Simple Wilderness. It's about the flooding of the Swift River Valley during the creation of the Quabbin Reservoir. This poem is called Bald Eagle.
Bald Eagle. A sighting is what we long for when January wind slices across the ice. Long wings spread straight as a knife, white head lowered, eyes hungry for movement. Along the shore, sweep of feathers sounds like forgiveness. What was almost lost nests here, sins redeemed in the counting.
That's poet Gail Thomas. She also runs a series of writing programs for seniors called Elder Voices. Another local poet is Carol Edelstein from Northampton, Massachusetts. She was the winner of the Perugia Press Award in 2005 for her poetry volume, The Disappearing Letters. Here's Edelstein's poem, Why This Happiness?
Why this happiness? Why do the lovers walk, jump, dance on the unmade bed? Last night she dreamed of a goat grazing on the tough blue weeds by the gully and woke to the rhythmic sounds of her own chewing. He dreamed he opened a suitcase and found there a clean shirt just his size, a neatly rolled pair of socks, and a real weather front, cumulonimbus clouds which rose up, expanded, and actually rained in their little attic room. How do you say lightning in French? He asked her. It could be bon voyage, she said. It could be petit déjeuner. She was laughing. She stood up and started to jump. It could be pomme de terre. Now you know all my French. It rained in my dream, mademoiselle, he said. Were you already awake? He stood up then, too, and walked around her while she jumped.
Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice, airing on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. Happy holidays and a happy new year. You can take Writer's Voice right with you on your holiday travels by getting our podcast. We've just moved the podcast to our own website rather than linking to an external host, so if you're already subscribed, make sure to switch to the new feed. You can get it at writersvoice.net. And you can find web-only content at our website, like interview segments that didn't make it to broadcast. Right now, you can hear podcasting master Rob Walch talk about copyright issues and making money with podcasts. You can also hear last week's interview with him on the newest podcast. You can find all that and more at writersvoice.net. As always, please send your thoughts, comments, and suggestions to write@writersvoice.net. or comment directly on our blog. Next week, join us for an interview with poet and director of the National Endowment for the Arts, Dana Gioia. He talks about what the NEA is doing to turn more Americans onto great books. And we'll hear a New Year's story of Provence read by yours truly. Until next week, I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.